Hi, it's Francis Lam. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more information on anything you hear today, just go to splendidtable.org. Here's this week's show. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. School gardens, community vegetable patches, fish farms and tanks, the urban farming movement takes all kinds of forms. And there are so many great things that happen when people grow food in cities. There are educational opportunities, you use less energy and transport, the plants help clean the air, and it just plain feels good for people to be closer to their food. But scientist Caleb Harper believes that indoor urban farming can do something more. It can actually create the best tasting, most nutritious, least energy intensive crops anywhere. Now, I admit this can sound ridiculous. Great farms are all about the character they have, their particular blend of sun and air and soil, and a warehouse full of lettuce beds has no character. But Caleb is a researcher at MIT and the leader of a group of nerd farmers. They work on something they call the food computer, which can closely detect and allow you to adjust the growing conditions of any plant in the room. And he thinks this is the future of urban farming, and maybe just the future of food. Thanks so much for joining us today, Caleb.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So there are so many things that make a great farm great, right? You start with the farmers, of course, but also the kind of sunlight it gets, the composition of the soil, all kinds of stuff. But you're trying to bring all those characteristics to growing plants indoors.
Exactly. If someone says, the best tomato in the world comes from Tuscany on the north side of the slope with a happy cow next door, you know, we try to factor in all of the, what we would call biotic or abiotic stress, most people would call climate, that caused those specific genetics to create the flavor that they like. And so we try to figure that out and then in the process use the least amount of resources, less water, less energy, less nutrition loss from transportation so that we can make a good product that's healthy and available in our cities.
I assume that means you also like pipe in audio of the happy cow mooing just to make sure that's covered.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my freshmen that come into my lab at MIT, the first thing they want to do is put the plants through Mozart and then put the plants through like Tupac. And see, and you know who wins between Mozart and Tupac? Tupac, because it's all about micro vibrations, which in the natural world you'd call wind. So you actually need wind inside of these environments, because the plant then gets stressed by the wind so that it can start to grow taller, so that it's morphologically correct, or you just say it's formed correctly. And so those micro vibrations of Tupac really help it out.
That's incredible. So, okay, so once you have all these factors, and I imagine the more you do it, the more you learn what these factors are.
That's a bleeding edge of science. Like, we've never before had the ability to gather so much data so cheaply. And we've also never before had the ability to process so much data so cheaply. Now, with advancements in robotics, advancements in sensors technology, and data processing, we can really start to get at some kind of basic science that maybe we haven't been able to do before.
Yeah. This is probably going to drive you crazy because this is going to be like a dumb thing to say.
No.
But it's almost like, oh, you're creating a virtual reality for these plants that is
in fact
reality.
No, that's totally true. It's not dumb at all because, you know, one of the things that limits agriculture and agricultural science is seasons. And so we go season to season. We try to make changes. We select for genetics that did well in that season. But we have a lot of kind of asynchronistic or non-categorized variables during that season. So imagine that you could run the season 10,000 times. And if you could run the season 10,000 times, you could try all different kinds of things that you would have done and see which one worked out the best without having to wait, 10,000 years? And so it's really that idea of how could we make agriculture and plant science more like computing?
So how are we going to get to the point where this happens on every other block in every other city? How will this scale up?
So right now, I think it's bubbling in a kind of a entrepreneurial realm. So there's a lot of startups, and I mean, Japan, China, Europe, United States, hundreds of millions of dollars going into this. But what I think needs to happen, and what my group is trying to be a part of, is the sharing of this knowledge so that it can scale up. And so there are so many unanswered questions. We need trillions of data points. We need 100,000 images to do any machine learning. And so we've taken all of our plans, all of our software, all of our hardware, and made it open source. And what that means is you can access it for free, you can use it for whatever you want, and you contribute as part of the project, kind of like a citizen science for, let's call it, horticulture or botany. In that process, there are now, after the last year and a half, people in 40 countries around the world contributing to our project, contributing either code or they're growing in the bots, whatever they want to grow, whatever excites them, they grow. We're able to collect data on that, and it starts to kind of build up this data set that we can use. Yeah. And it's really the way of the future. When you look at Tesla open sourcing their patents so that more infrastructure can be built, part of that network economy. Apple open sourcing their app developer language. This is because of our networked world. And there's never been a time in human history where you can get more people working on a single problem if you share that infrastructure. And I don't think anything is more important than how are we going to feed all the people in the world with the least amount of resources and the most amount of amazing flavors and good nutrition.
Well, this sounds incredible. And good luck to you. But I think that means good luck to all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a nerd farmer inside of all of us. You know, I think of it this way. A lot of us think, oh, we don't have a green thumb. Well, what if a green thumb was a digital asset? What if I could download a farmer's eye that took 60 years to cultivate, that beautiful eye that can tell you what's wrong with a plant? Whereas you might come into this saying, oh, my house plants are always dying. I don't know what to do with them. Well, what if we could make that a program? What if you literally downloaded tomato, and that tomato meant that you put a seed in an environment that was created by a master gardener or by a master horticulturalist or by a chef that knew what to do to this plant in the northern part of Spain to get the most beautiful expression of flavor, but we captured that as a recipe. So you downloaded it, you grew it, and all of a sudden, you're in the Basque region in your apartment.
Right. That's incredible. What other technologies do you see right now in terms of farming and agriculture that, you know, us as lay people don't know about?
Well, I think in a bigger context, you would just say that what I'm seeing as a general shift is this kind of coming together of biologic and digital technologies. For example, rapid sequencing, the ability to get to the genetics of whatever we're interested in very quickly. And then now the ability to edit those genetics. So there's something called CRISPR, and CRISPR is a system where it just makes it very easy and very cheap to edit something within a genome. And I know, you know, this might be something that people are concerned about, but when you think about the fact that everything we've eaten in our entire life has been genetically modified because it's been trait selected for hundreds of years down to become the corn that we eat today.
Breeding sweeter and sweeter corn or something like that.
Exactly, or bigger, or whatever it is we were looking for. What CRISPR is the ability to do what used to take 100 years or 10 years in the lab in a day. And so that can radically change what we're able to do with agriculture in the short term. I think there's also some amazing things going on in the microbiome. I don't know if you're following the conversation about human microbiome, but in the plant world, we're saying root microbiome. So what should be in the soil, maybe that isn't there from the methods of farming that we've been using that hasn't cultivated that microbiome, or maybe it was never there in the first place, or for whatever reason. What microbes, what bacteria would we want to put back into the soil that would cause a much better plant to come out? And even more radical than that, people are starting to engineer microbes. So if you know the process that you're trying to help, you can literally engineer a helper microbe to go into the soil to cause, you know, a more efficient, better, however you qualify it, plant. So I think these technologies, and then obviously things like microsatellites and drones, getting a lot more data on our fields. So there's a startup recently that has created more data about in-field farming in the last 5 years than the USDA has in its entire existence. And so I think that's part of that cheaper sensors, cheaper processing power. So we're getting a very described field. We're now getting the ability to modify very quickly within genome, trait select using CRISPR. And then we're looking at how would we intentionally design the soil with microbes?
This is fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in, Caleb.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Caleb Harper is the director of the Open Agriculture Initiative at the MIT Media Lab. You know, thinking about what Caleb just said about not having to wait for the seasons to get great crops, it made me wonder if we wouldn't lose something by losing seasonality. I mean, if we could have perfect produce all the time, would we miss that glorious moment when you can finally slice into that tomato you've been waiting for? And so this year around me, the tomatoes were late coming in, but when they finally got good, my wife and I were just thrilled. And that night, I came home from the market, like with the first good summer tomatoes we got, and we made our favorite summer tomato pasta. And it's barely even a recipe. You know, when the tomatoes are great, you just grab as many as you want to eat. For us, the two of us, it was about 1.5 pounds. You dice them, season them in a bowl with salt, a little bit of vinegar, and plenty of good olive oil. You mix it up and you let the juices run out. And then you layer on a little something green, maybe some herbs or maybe a little handful of arugula leaves, and then a couple thin slices of onion. You boil some spaghetti, and right when it's drained, right when it's still piping hot, you plop all that right on the bowl and wait 2 minutes to take the raw edge off the onions. And meanwhile, you can shave on some cheese or just sort of sit there and twiddle your thumbs, whatever you need to do. Then stir it up, slurp away, and the olive oil and the tomato juice make this broth. And when you're done with the pasta, you have this gazpacho-ish soup. And it's like two dishes in one, and I can't get enough of it. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe I wouldn't mind eating that all year round. Coming up, it's the international world of eggs. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates, to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. You know, there probably aren't a whole lot of style trends restaurant line cooks are responsible for, but they did make kitchen and grill tongs every home cook's must-have accessory. Well, this week's check-in with America's Test Kitchen is all about tong to tong tong tong. This is ATK's Lisa McManus talking with our producer, Sally Swift.
Hey, Lisa, great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
So I have a story for you. I was thinking about you guys in my kitchen the other day because I have this seriously bad pair of grill tongs that are worthless for everything. They've never worked. But my husband has put an amplifier in my kitchen at the very top of the cupboard that I can't reach the volume, except I can with those rubber tip tongs. So now they have a really dedicated use. And I'm not one for keeping a piece of equipment that would only work in one place, but I think they've found their home. But it occurs to me, tongs are really badly designed.
Yes, yeah, so many tongs are horrible. They're just either so big and clunky, they look like they're made for Paul Bunyan, you know, or they're so lightly built that they're not really working for serious cooks. They're all flimsy and they have pathetic pinchers and you can't really grab anything and they don't line up and they just sort of flop. And they just make grilling harder than it has to be.
So Lisa, what do you think makes a great pair of tongs?
Well, it really should feel like a natural extension of your hands and it shouldn't make you work harder. It should be about Our ideal one was about 16 inches, weighed about 8 or 9 ounces, so not too light and flimsy, not too heavy to hold up and pick up other heavy things. Pinchers that really meet nicely in the middle and don't get out of alignment. scalloped head, which the scalloped edges really grab things without ripping or tearing or snagging. A locking mechanism that you can easily open and close with one hand, especially the opening part. Mm-hmm. The closing part, you don't really care. You can use two hands. But the opening, as you're walking toward the grill with your platter of food in one hand and your tongs in the other, it's nice to just be able to pop it on your hip and open it up.
You betcha.
Yeah.
A gunslinger.
Right, exactly.
So how did you test these?
We went through all kinds of things. We tested, we made light foods and heavy foods, round, awkward foods. So we did grilled asparagus spears. We did corn on the cob. We did full racks of Memphis ribs, a whole 10-piece barbecued chicken dish where you have a lot of pieces that have to be moved quickly and they're all different shapes and sizes and you don't want to scrape off a barbecue sauce or rip the skin. We picked up single toothpicks and glass 1-pound jars of salsa. And those really gave us a sense of how controlled they were and how precise they could be. And all of these things really matter because you don't want to have to think about your tongs when you're cooking. You want to be thinking about the food and the fun and what you're going to get to eat.
We have low expectations of tongs, I have to say.
Oh, and we should have higher ones. These are really important.
So, Lisa, what was your winner?
Well, I have them right here.
Of course you do.
They're called the OXO Good Grip 16-inch locking tongs, and they're really the ideal tongs. They are just 8 ounces, so they're not too heavy or too light. They're 16 inches long, gives you enough space from the grill, but not so much that it's hard to pick things up. They're really agile. They're very comfortable. They have a nice springy tension that feels just right. They have the scalloped pinchers that can really pick up a single toothpick or pick up a big, heavy glass jar, no problem. They unlock and lock in a snap. Just push the little tab on the end. And they clean up in the dishwasher, which is ideal.
And that just, is ideal.
They're $15. And if I had to just take one tool out to the grill, it would be these tongs.
You are doing a public service here, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus leads all of the equipment testing and ingredient tastings for America's Test Kitchen. You can find details on those grilling tong tests on our website, splendidtable.org. California is one of the great wine-producing places in the world. It's a juggernaut, really, when you measure by quantity or quality. But there are still underdogs to cheer for in California wine. Like the people who grow Rhone varieties, like Grenache and Syrah. These reds are earthy, fruity, a little spicy, and they're great with fall foods like roasts and stews. Now, these grapes were brought to California by immigrants over 100 years ago, and they flourished until Prohibition upended everything. But these varietals have made a comeback. Our contributor Russ Parsons talked with wine writer Patrick Comiskey to find out about the state of California Rhones today.
Patrick Comiskey, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thanks, Russ.
American wine drinkers tend to focus on a few varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir. The Rhone offers dozens of varieties. What can someone new to these kinds of wines expect?
Well, interestingly, there is a great range because the Rhone Valley is a long north-south valley. And so you get continental flavors and you get Mediterranean flavors. So you get powerful red wines like Syrah, and you get light-bodied white wines like Picpoul and Grenache Blanc. In the middle, you have some of the most powerful, heady wines from warm regions like Châteauneuf-du-Pape and Gigondas. These are Grenache-based wines, and they are heady, voluptuous, and extremely powerful red wines.
And how do those translate when they're planted in the United States? I mean, do they come across exactly the same, or does the climate and the geography dictate some changes?
It dictates a lot of changes, but in general, California is a warmer climate than most regions in the Rhone Valley, and so you end up having a little bit lusher, more approachable red wines, a little bit more powerful, richer white wines.
And so where is that American Rhone centered geographically? And what are some of the key wineries that people should be looking for now? Who do you like?
Well, historically, they ended up centering themselves on the central coast of California. Paso Robles is a very strong, has a very strong focus on Rhone varieties, but also areas of the Santa Barbara County as well. In particular, the wines of Ballard Canyon and in the Santa Maria Valley as well. Bienesito Vineyard being one of the oldest plantings and one of the coolest earliest cool climate plantings of the Central Coast. That's where you'll find two very, very good go-to wineries that are found in this category. The first is Coupe Winery. They are based in the Santa Maria Valley, but they make wines from all around the Central Coast. They have a basic bottling of Central Coast Syrah that will knock your socks off for less than $20. It's a terrific bottle of wine. And he makes all kinds of really thrilling single vineyard wines as well, of Grenache, of Roussanne, of Marsan. He's one of the earliest producers of Marsan in the country. Go a little bit further north and you end up at Tablas Creek Vineyards. This is an historic winery. This is a joint partnership between an American family, the Haas family, and the Perrin family of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. This amounts to the first French investment in Rhone varietal winemaking on California soil. And for that reason, it's very important. But they're also remarkably stylish wines of a certain French reserve, I would say.
The Rhone guys, they seem a little bit different. Give us some idea of some of the characters that are involved.
Well, the real thing that set the Rhone movement apart and the reason we can call it a movement at all is because of the personalities that were involved. We had some of the most colorful characters, colorful winemaking characters that we've ever had in the history of California winemaking. The person you have to lead with when you're talking about characters is Randall Graham of Bonnie Doon Winery in Santa Cruz. Randall is a remarkable, verbally gifted, antic, a little crazy, completely peripatetic winemaker who settled on Rhone varieties in the early 80s because he had felt like he was failing as a Pinot Noir winemaker. He ended up making one of the first Rhone blends in California. It was called Cigar Volant. And he put on his label a clever and a little bit mysterious pun that involved a flying saucer, and the rest is history. I venture to say that there was almost no humor on any California wine labels ever before Cigar Volant.
And what's the story behind the Cigar Volant? Why did he choose that name?
So he read a book by John Livingston Learmonth on the Rhone Valley, and Livingston Learmonth found a small decree that was issued in the 50s by some bureaucrat in France, which forbid any flying saucers to land in the vineyards of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. It's a good thing, too, because it never happened. However, Randall seized upon this as one of the stranger anecdotes that originated from this particular part of the world and decided to call his wine Cigar Volant, which is French for flying saucer or flying cigar.
Patrick, it's a fascinating book about wonderful wines. Thank you so much for being on Splendid Table with us.
Thanks very much, Russ. Thanks for having me.
Patrick Comiskey is the author of American Rhone: How Maverick Winemakers Changed the Way America Drinks. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach. And you can find some of Patrick's Rhone picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Of all of the elemental foods, eggs are something I think we can talk about forever. We eat them for any meal of the day. We eat them sweet, we eat them savory. For a lot of people, they're the first thing you learn to cook, and even for world-class chefs, mastering something as simple as a plain omelet can be a total obsession. And that brings me to Rachel Kong. She's written a book aptly titled All About Eggs. It's a serious plunge into their incredible edibleness. It's got egg recipes across different cultures, egg recipes that exist in only one place, eggs from different birds. It's an ovarian obsession, and our contributor, the New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, sat down with Rachel to talk about it.
Rachel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
So in the introduction, you write that this is a book about eggs, but that it's also a book about humankind and our connection to one another. What do you mean by that?
So that's just one of a few very hyperbolic claims that I make in the book. But yeah, I mean, this book is all about eggs, but it's also all about the ways that humans are eating and preparing eggs. We eat eggs all around the world. Pretty much anywhere there are birds, people eat eggs, which is essentially everywhere. So eggs are this common vocabulary that we have. You know, if you're in a foreign country and you don't know the language, the odds are high that people there are eating eggs and you can order an egg there. So it's really about showing us how similar we are despite so many cultural differences.
I love that so many techniques are used cross-culturally. You write about shakshuka.
Yeah, shakshuka is a dish in North Africa and the Middle East, and it's eggs poached in tomato sauce. It's just so delicious with, you know, like a hunk of crusty bread. But of course, because it's so delicious, lots of other cultures do that kind of thing as well. Eggs in purgatory in Italy, which is also eggs in a spicy tomato sauce. There's a dish in Mexico that is the same sort of deal, but with native green peppers there. So other dishes are things like eggs hard-boiled and steeped in tea in Taiwan and in China. They will crack the eggs so that there's a beautiful marbling that happens all around the egg. And it's just a street snack, essentially. You can even find it at the 7-Elevens there in Taiwan. And that's similar to a type of egg they make in Iran, which is something they make overnight so that they don't have to cook during the Sabbath. And they steep the eggs there in onion skins, which also cause the eggs to be brown on the outside and have this beautiful patterning on the inside.
Now, we always think of chicken eggs. Maybe some of us can get duck eggs. But there are lots of different types of birds whose eggs we eat. Can you talk about some of the other eggs?
Quail eggs are actually used in a lot of Chinese medicine. You know, they're pretty cute. We have a recipe for deep-fried quail eggs called kwek kwek, which are a street food in the Philippines. And duck eggs are very rich. They have a dark orange yolk, and they're great for things like cakes that need a rich, yolky yolk. But I was really excited to learn about some cool bird eggs that I had never heard about before. One of them is from a bird called the tinamou, and the tinamou is essentially a South American bird that is very plain looking and brown, but it lays these beautiful eggs that look like they've been dipped in paint. They're really iridescent. Sometimes they're purple or turquoise. They just look like fake plastic eggs, but they are these beautiful duck egg size eggs that some farmers down in Chile are trying to popularize. They have a little bit more iron than the regular chicken egg, and so their whites are a little bit pink.
Mm.
And no one's really sure why the eggs are so beautiful, but one theory is that they attract male incubators to the nests to come sit on these shiny, beautiful eggs. So that was a really exciting egg to learn about. Another egg that I found people eat near the Arctic Circle, like in Iceland, is the egg of a bird called the guillemot. And they are these seabirds, and their eggs are these conical, speckled turquoise eggs that are really seasonal. You can only get them really in the springtime in Iceland, and people will rappel down cliffs to harvest them from the edge of these cliffs.
Wow.
And yeah, they're really amazing looking. You should just Google image search them. And like, they're just a bright turquoise. They have these beautiful speckled patterns on them. And the patterns are actually useful as well. So the guillemots lay their eggs in these large communal nests on the edge of the cliff. And all of the birds lay their eggs in the same place. But these speckled patterns help the birds find the eggs that belong to them.
Oh, wow. So it's like a little marker, so you know which one is your little baby chick.
Yeah, it's like being at a party and writing your name on a cup, you know?
Rachel, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Kong is the author of All About Eggs. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner, Changing the Game. And if you go to splendidtable.org, you can find Rachel's recipe for a classic heart stopper of a bar snack. They're called Scotch eggs, and these are boiled eggs, wrapped in sausage, breaded, and then fried. Or if you're in a more wholesome mood, you can also go to our website to check out this week's video. It's with Leanne Brown, the mind behind the cookbook she gives away called Good and Cheap. Eat well on $4 a day. And coming up, I get to talk to you. And the best places in Miami to get tapas, smoothies, and a full tank of gas. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. Well, all right. It's time for us to talk. Find us on Facebook or Twitter or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. We want to know what you're thinking about. All right, so we have Kate calling from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kate, what do you want to talk about?
So we have a group of friends, and we're kind of in a cooking book group. So we read books and talk about stuff. And then we've done this sort of group cooking thing where we're trying to make, we gather maybe six women, have a pretty big, nice kitchen, and we've made things like applesauce. I think we turned 200 pounds of apples into applesauce, and wow, we do 1,000 tamales. So we're trying to make food that kind of matters to have numbers and then enough that's easy to freeze and store, because most of us are teachers or don't have a lot of time or money, so it's nice to have food that you can just whip out of the freezer and eat. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of run out of ideas of things to cook. So we tried lasagna, which didn't work that well because it was hard to store. And we've tried cookies, which were fun, but not, you know, sort of long-term, you know, it's not what you want to eat first thing in the morning. So the burritos have been great. The tamales were great. Applesauce was awesome. So we wondered if you had other ideas for stuff that matters to have a big group to cook for and you can freeze and use later.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I think tamales is and applesauce, those sound perfect because if you have a lot of people, you have a lot of hands, and you don't want some people twiddling their thumbs waiting for, you know, this to happen before they can get in. So you kind of want projects that really require a lot of assembly, right? And that's, you know, it may be fun and meditative to do by yourself, but by the time you got to your 85th tamale, you're probably sick of it. So 1,000 is a really big haul. So I don't know, going down that path, I'm thinking of my youth. I was raised in a Chinese family, and maybe you could do a wonton or dumpling wrapping party.
Oh, wow. That's a great idea.
Yeah, because they freeze really well, and you can go out and buy just stacks. You live in Portland, so I know there are Asian markets nearby for sure.
Yeah, actually, one's going in like a half mile from our house. So.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, you can just buy stacks of wonton skins, make big pots of filling. I mean, I love a classic ground pork, a little bit of chopped shrimp, minced ginger, minced scallions, a little bit of oyster sauce, and like maybe a little bit of cornstarch to keep it smooth. You can find like 1,000 recipes online or in cookbooks.
Awesome.
But you can make a big pot of that. You can make other kinds of fillings. And when it comes time to fill them, I'm not a great dumpling maker. In fact, I once went to dim sum school, and it was a four-day program. And halfway through the second day, the instructor asked me, "Why are you here? Maybe you shouldn't try to do dim sum. Maybe we'll do something else." So I'm not actually a talented folder and pleater. So I'll give you my dad's way of folding wontons. My dad has like literally never cooked when I was a kid, and only once, and I mean really once, did I see him like handle food. And he was sitting at a table, and he was helping to fill wontons. And I learned from him. I didn't learn from someone who actually knew what they were doing. But I just remember that really special moment. I sat down with my dad, and Pop was filling in wonton skins. And so you take the wonton skin. Typically, it's a square, about 3 inches on each side. You hold it sort of when it's like a diamond shape in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You take not a whole lot, maybe a tablespoon, maybe less, 2 teaspoons full of filling. Drop it in the middle, have a little bowl of water, dip a finger in the water, and then trace the 2 edges of the wonton skin.
Okay.
And then you just kind of fold it over. So now it goes from a diamond to a triangle.
Yep.
Right? and kind of push out the air from around the filling, seal it, like just pinch it shut on the two edges, and then bring the two edges that are sort of flush with the filling, if that makes sense. Sort of fold them over like you're closing a bathrobe, basically is what you're doing. And then dip your finger again to get those two ends wet and pinch them together. And that's kind of it. It's not beautiful. It's not, doesn't look like a wonton necessarily. You might get in a beautiful restaurant, but it holds it together. And the nice thing about that is it makes a nice flat shape for you that you can then lay on a sheet tray, maybe with some parchment, and lay them out individually, pop them in the freezer, and you can freeze them. You can freeze, you know, hundreds and hundreds at a time if you have the freezer space. And then when you take them out, when they're nice and frozen, you can stuff them into, you can actually lay them pretty flat in a Ziploc bag, in a big gallon Ziploc bag, and you just start stacking them up.
That's awesome. Do you have to cook them before you freeze them or anything, or they just can...
No. Yeah. Freeze them raw. And then I often just pull them right out and drop them in the boiling water from the frozen state because they're so small. They cook pretty fast, just a few minutes. So you'll watch them float. When they float, they're starting to get there. And then maybe cook them a few minutes more. You can take one out, cut it in half if you're not sure if it's cooked or not. You know, if you probably got a bunch of them in the pot. And pretty much when one is done, they're all done. And you strain them out and you can serve them in soup. You can serve them, you know, with a nice light like broth, or you can do them just by themselves with a little bit of maybe like a soy sauce with a few fresh chilies cut into it, maybe a little dash of vinegar as a sort of dipping sauce.
Oh, that's awesome. This is perfect. Oh, I'm so excited. We will schedule our October meeting for a wonton party. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
Bye.
All right, we have Kat from Washington, D.C. Hey, Kat, how are you?
Hi, Francis. Thanks for taking my question.
No, it's a pleasure. What is the question?
Okay, so I've been some variation of vegan or vegetarian since I was a teenager. I cook a lot, and I have an adventurous palate. I've been sort of exploring Indian cooking, and I recently decided to reduce my wheat intake. So I was curious about Indian flours that are made with things other than wheat. So I got a flour at an international market. It's called Kala Chana Basan. And underneath it says Farine de Gram Noir, which translates to black gram flour, which doesn't really mean anything to me. So I'm just trying to figure, I know there are a lot of different Indian flours that are made with things that are not wheat, and I'm assuming they all have different names, and like one flour will have several different names, maybe. I don't know. It's confusing.
Sure. There are versions of it. So chana in most South Asian languages means chickpea. Mm-hmm. So what you have is a chickpea flour, and kala chana is what they call the black chickpea, which is a darker, you can sometimes see them, and they're a little unusual to find in stores unless you're in a South Asian market, but they're really like small, dark chickpeas. And, you know, it's very protein rich. I'm not an expert in baking with non-wheat flours, but what I understand with chickpea flour is often it's used for batter and batter type things. Mm-hmm. So like pakoras, if you know, and like pakoras, those like those really nice earthy tasting vegetable fritters you'll often find in Indian restaurants are often made with chickpea flour, I think. And for me, you know, I have a bag of chickpea flour in my pantry, and I actually have it because I learned to make a Burmese dish from a Burmese cook. And she showed me this really cool technique where she called it tohu, which I assume is, you know, related to tofu. And it's, we made it almost like you would make a porridge or a polenta. Uh-huh. And then we turned it out onto a plate or a sheet tray, spread it out, let it cool. And it got really nice and firm. So it became sliceable. And so we used it in this case, the particular dish we made was a Burmese dish called tohu tok, which is you take those pieces of chickpea tofu, I guess you could call it. And then we dressed them in a really amazing dressing of tamarind and fish sauce and garlic, and then sprinkled the top with fried garlic and fried shallots. Yeah, it's crazy delicious.
Yeah.
But the method was we stirred together a batter of like 1 cup of the flour to 2 cups of water, a little bit of salt, turmeric, and then just kind of cooked it in a pot, stirring the whole time until it got really, really thick, like a really thick cake batter. And then when you spread it out and let it cool, it'll firm up for you.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you can do that and you can dress it, like in this case with the salad, use a lot of nice acids in it, use something savory, a lot of herbs, or you could probably treat it like you would a firm polenta. You could cut it into cakes and sear it. Mm-hmm. And that actually is, you know, moving to a totally different part of the world. If you go into like the Mediterranean, Southern Europe, there are all these beautiful chickpea pancakes and chickpea fritters,
right. Yeah.
Like panelle in Sicily or panisse in Southern France and socca and farinata, where you can make these beautiful pancakes and like basically you're frying them in a ton of olive oil, so they're really delicious.
Yeah, I actually have used chickpea flour before. I didn't realize that this was chickpea flour also. Yeah.
Oh, great. Now, honestly, I haven't ever really cooked with kala chana, the black chickpea flour.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it behaves super differently.
Right.
I would guess it's pretty similar. There might be a difference in, you know, the ratio of water you might use in the recipe or something like that. But I would bet you'd get that really nice, nutty, toasty sort of, beany flavor, that sort of proteiny kind of flavor.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Kat, and have fun with your bag of chickpea flour.
Thanks so much. Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye. And remember, hey, you can call us anytime with questions or thoughts. Leave us a voicemail, 1-800-537-5252. Well, earlier in the show, we talked about the future of urban farming, and now we're getting to what might be the future of urban eating. I'm talking about gas station dining. Now, this isn't a new idea. Anyone who's ever taken a serious road trip has heard about some mythical gas station barbecue where, you know, they only serve on Tuesdays between 3 and 3:22 in the afternoon, but if you get there in time, it'll change your life. But, you know, those places used to be in smaller towns where the gas station was the best place to catch people passing by, but the new wave of gas station cuisine is all about city economics. Rents keep going up, electric cars are on the horizon, and station owners are trying to find a way to get people to come through the door. So why not with tapas, superfood smoothies, and Venezuelan burgers? Maria Bacalopolo takes a spin around the booming gas station restaurant scene in Miami.
Stick around for a quick car wash today.
If you want to shock your dinner date, tell them you'd like to book a table inside a mobile gas station, then watch their jaw drop when they step inside.
Here we are as we enter the gas station. You're going to see kind of this store directly to our left here. You have your motor oil, our gums, and our chocolates here, which you'd expect. And if you just veer your eye a little bit to the right, you'll begin to see our cases of wine that greet you at the door, and a little bit more, our cake display in our bakery cafe. And if you keep on walking over here, you're going to begin to see our cool wine selection here, where we have Dom Perignon Cristal all the way down to some basic Chardonnays for everyday consumption.
Carlos and Javier Fonseca are savvy 20-somethings. Their lives revolve around El Carajo, the only gas station in the city of Miami that can also claim to be a fine dining establishment. El Carajo was opened in the 1980s by their father, Richard Fonseca, a lover of the finer things in life. He began offering foods beyond your typical convenience store. El Carajo was inspired by a family trip to Europe.
He went to a rest stop on the Autostrada in Italy, and in one of the locations he had some of the best food he'd ever had, and out of a little inexpensive plastic cup they poured him a phenomenal Brunello, and he went, you know what, we can have some of the best offerings in both food and in wine in a gas station, and people should appreciate it because it's no different than being anywhere else and being able to enjoy it.
It took a while for El Carajo to reach the level of popularity it enjoys today.
We've definitely had people, they get invited for dinner, they get out of their car, they see it's in a gas station, they go, oh, it's in there.
Relying on their quality product and word of mouth has garnered steady growth. Their sizzling chorizo, dates covered in bacon, and the popular croquettes are all served to meet the most demanding palate. From fine wine and tapas to a less hedonistic experience, we head over to Mendez Fuel for a craft beer and a car wash.
I'm Michael Mendez, owner of Mendez Fuel.
I am Andrew Mendez, VP of Mendez Fuel.
Andrew keeps an impressive stock of craft beer, and 16 are on tap ready to fill growlers and crowlers, bottles and cans sealed on the spot. He makes sure he highlights the local breweries. Next to the beer taps, Andrew's brother Michael Mendez has the hits for the health conscious, including organic wraps, salads, and icy Brazilian acai bowls loaded with fruit, honey, and coconut, and a range of fresh organic fruit juice blends.
I will say that as a gas station owner, and if anybody else is a gas station owner listening to this, if they're not trying to create a food service component or trying to create a niche in the market, they're gonna die. Today's gas station, the future is food service and being unique, because we're a dime a dozen. You know, the margins on gas are minimal. You want people to come inside, you want people to spend money inside. You know, it's hot in Miami. You know, it rains a lot. For us, the challenge in this store is that our pumps are probably 50 feet away from inside the store and they're not covered. You know, how do you get that person to come inside and walk either through the rain or through the heat inside? And you know, we've managed to do it.
The next stop is on the way to the world-famous South Beach, a very body-conscious place. Off Alton Road and inside a tiny Texaco station is Milk Gone Nuts, named after the homemade almond, cashew, and coconut milks, sweetened with dates and maple syrup. They have irresistible vegan chocolate ice cream sandwiches and delicious protein pancakes. Other big draws are the chocolate peanut butterlicious shake and their Italian-style ice pops. Their coconut milk made daily in their kitchen is like nothing you'll find at a grocery store. Truly the nectar of the tropical gods. Owner Sarah Tasher Suarez.
We have our regular people, we have the office people, we have people from car wash. It's like, oh my God, you know, I can get gas, I can get a car wash, I can get lunch, I can get a smoothie, and life is great.
If you're heading west near Miami Airport, Pepito's Plaza in Doral will set the dial at the opposite end from vegan. Offerings include a made-in-house three-meat burger with a fried egg on top, stacked so high you can barely fit your jaw around it. Washed down with a chilled rice milk, it could easily lead to a lengthy siesta.
My name is Maria Alexia. I'm a co-owner and founder. We started this with the station manager, the gas station manager. We met him because we were neighbors. We are from Venezuela.
A car wash in the back became a seating area with a walk-up window where you can order the Venezuelan-themed fast food based on hamburgers and hot dogs. Because of the large number of Venezuelans in Doral, the area is nicknamed Doralzuela. It is also the name of Pepito's signature burger.
It has the beef patty, the chicken, the pork loin, ham, egg, cheese, avocado, potato sticks, and all the lettuce, tomato for the diet, and all the sauces you want.
Real estate prices in Miami are skyrocketing. Business owners are getting creative with their square footage. And everybody needs to stop at the gas station. With electric vehicles set to increase and customers stopping longer, waiting for a charge to complete, these new models of how gas stations serve the public point the way to a more colorful and tasty future.
Maria Bacalapolo is a Miami-based journalist and filmmaker. And that's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us again next week. And in the meantime, there's a quote from Michael Pollan I want to share. It goes, "It's not food if it arrived through the window of your car." But hey, don't you think leaving the car to go into the gas station can count? And before I go, let me say one more word about our website, splendidtable.org. It's been redesigned, and you can find tons of recipes, register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, or take a look at our ever-growing video collection. And subscribe to our podcast. You'll find tons of interviews with people who have been shaping the food world for over two decades. And if you like us, please leave us a review where you get your podcasts. And this summer, Garrison Keillor, along with Heather Massey, Aoife O'Donovan, Rich Dworsky and the Roadhounds, and Mr. Fred Newman, will be crossing the country with the Prairie Home Love and Comedy Tour. Tickets, locations, info, and more are at prairiehome.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.